Okay, 1 Peter chapter 1, and we'll just begin reading with verse 3 again. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to His abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. Now, we have already discussed the fact that what the being born again or begotten again is in verse 3, that it is accomplished through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, being the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep, to that inheritance. Now, what we want to talk about is the inheritance in the question under consideration here. And we talked about the phrase, or we made note of the phrase, incorruptible and undefiled and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. I just want to look at each of those clauses that are found in that section in chapter 1 and verse 4. We wanted to just relate what we ended our class on last week, and that is what we mean here by the word incorruptible. And I gave you Thayer's definition that it means not liable to corruption or decay, that it is something imperishable. And the point that that I wanted to make, that I think is very, very good, not mine, but one that I came across, is that if you think about the created universe, that if we talk about something that is incorruptible, that does not perish, that does not decay, that there is absolutely nothing in the physical universe to which that can be applied, as far as physical properties. And the reason we say that is because in 2 Peter, the third chapter, when the apostle talks about the judgment day, you'll notice there, thank you, in 2 Peter chapter 3 and looking at verse 10 of the text, 2 Peter 3 and verse 10, the statement is made that the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with great noise, the elements will melt with fervent heat, both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. And that indicates that there will be an end to all things that are physical. And so it is appropriate that the word incorruptible be used in a way of contrasting that which is to come with that which is present. And I think all of these definitions, or all these terms, as you look at their definitions and the usage, will do the exact same thing in that regard. It serves as a contrast between what we have now and what we have promised to us in the future. And so that's the first term that we made note of, incorruptible, which would, in effect, that term would be something that would be exclusive of all that we have in our created world, but what we are looking forward to is something that is without end, in contrast to the world and the universe, which will come to an end at that day of judgment. Of course, we know other things that are easily corrupted, but milk spoils, to give you an example, or bread gets moldy, those kinds of things that very quickly will turn and decay. But you don't really think about that when you think about a lump of granite or something that or gold, pure gold. Those are things that you would consider to be somewhat incorruptible or imperishable. But ultimately, what Scripture reveals is that those things will be done away with as well. But what we have promised to us never will be. And so there is the contrast made. Questions, comments about that particular phrase? That's kind of what we covered last week. Okay, so that got us down to the next term, undefiled. And just give you the Thayer definition really quick. Unsoiled, free from that which by the nature of a thing is deformed and debased, or its force and vigor is impaired. Vine defines it as free from contamination. So when we talk about undefiled, in what way then is that an appropriate use or an appropriate description of our inheritance?
Ask the question again.
I didn't say it very clearly. Probably what I should not do is read the definition, then ask you to add to what the definition's already said. So let's just stop with that. Okay. Anybody have any comments about this concept of being undefiled? Do you see a distinction between incorruptible and undefiled? Are they sufficiently close in meaning to be somewhat synonymous?
Yeah, but to me, undefiled means pure, where uncorruptible means it can't be corrupted. You know, I know it's very similar, but one, you know, it means it's pure. Your inheritance is pure. It's sinless. There's no sin. It's pure, and it can't be corrupted. It will never be.
Okay. So one would have to do with the constancy of a particular object, for example, like I said, the lump of granite. Is something that it's unchanging. Whereas when we're talking about that which can be defiled, there can be added to it some ingredient which would make it poisonous or contaminated. So yeah, there's some slight differentiation we can make with regard to it. But again, with regard to those things, when we talk about the fact that our inheritance, which of course is referring to heaven, when you Jim mentioned that concept of sin, you know, it may be a concept that is somewhat difficult for us to understand, but this universe in which we live, in the world in which we live, there is corruption that is contained within it. And what is revealed to us from the Genesis account is that death entered into the world as a result of sin. That what you had was what we might refer to as a paradise. That God had created that was altered as a result of the sin of man. But that, since we understand and recognize that there will be no sin in heaven, then as a result of that, there is no corruption that will be there. So that kind of concept is something that we should perhaps make note of as we emphasize this. Yes?
Yes, you mentioned about granite, you know, it's stone and all that, and verse 7 about gold, but both the granite and the gold, those things will perish, as you read in 2 Peter, but the inheritance will not.
That's right.
And so there's the...
That's the difference, or that's what the Apostle Peter is seeking to establish, is the difference from the inheritance than what we have here. Josh, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out, too, when looking at this, that this is the type of passage that many of those in the world might use to justify the doctrine of once saved, always saved, where it talks about being incorruptible and undefiled, and it's obviously a misinterpretation of this. But I think that's important to point out, that, you know, that distinction. This doesn't mean that once saved, always saved. It means that once you are of the elect, that inheritance that you have, we talked about predestination a couple of weeks ago, and y'all might have talked about this a little bit last week, I don't know, I wasn't here, but that idea of being elect, it was the foreknowledge of God, you've got that inheritance, it's guaranteed, it's undefiled, it's incorruptible, it doesn't fade away, it's reserved for you. In other words, there's no outside agency that can take that away. Once you're of the elect, it's a guaranteed thing, which is a part of the hope that we live with. You know, we can be assured that God is going to fulfill His promises that He has given us. That reward of heaven is guaranteed, and there's nothing that can be done from the outside to take that away. But a key there also that we talked about is the obedience that it talks about in verse 2. You know, we've got to obey, and if we cease obeying, we're sinning. Sin separates us from God. We can forfeit ourselves. There's nobody outside of us. There's nothing outside that can take this away or forfeit it. But we ourselves can forfeit it through our disobedience, through sin. That's just something that I was thinking of when reading this, that the world doesn't, in the world don't understand.
I think what you said, right, that it's a misinterpretation of the text. Because in this particular context, I think that we have reached the point in this description that is not describing the security of the one who has reached this relationship with God. He's actually talking about the characteristics of that inheritance. And in other words, when we talk about what our inheritance is, what is our inheritance? It is an eternity in the presence of God in heaven. If you're going to describe the nature of that inheritance that you receive, It's not an idea as to whether you can forfeit or not, but when you obtain that, because you don't obtain it until you get to heaven. That's where it's reserved. It's reserved up in heaven. What kind of an inheritance is it? And so the attributes of this this inheritance here, it's not referring to the steadfastness, you know, the security of the believer, which I think Josh did a good job of in capsule form stating that the security of the believer is founded in his relationship with God. So long as he maintains that relationship, he is secure. But he can forfeit that relationship by turning away from God. In other words, no one can take it from you, but you can forfeit it.
He's not describing a Christian here. He's describing the inheritance.
Describing the inheritance. Yeah, yeah. So it's not. It's not referring to the. That's not even in the context. Earlier in he's discussing that. But again, there are other places where the surety of what we have received is something that is established, where that really does need to be differentiated. But an individual who's saying that the inheritance here has reference to the security of the believer, he's really taking something entirely out of context, as you indicated, because this is talking about the nature of that reward. What kind of reward is it? And the contrast is between that which is on earth, which is corruptible, can be defiled, can fade away, as contrasted to what you will have in heaven, which is the opposite of those things. So that gets us to the third phrase, and that is, does not fade away. So what does that indicate to you? Give me an illustration or an example.
Yeah. There are some things on earth that do last a long time. They're not completely incorruptible, like I've been saying, but they last a long time. But those things will often lose its luster and shine as age goes on. What we have with it being eternal and spiritual, as time goes on, it doesn't lose any of its shine, so to speak. It doesn't lose any of its effect. So as time goes on,
you certainly won't grow bored with it, because yes, it doesn't lose that luster. That's a good point. See, what we're saying here is there are three different adjectives which describe, that are very similar, because, you know, if you say incorruptible, undefiled, does not fade, well, you know, you're basically talking about the same thing, but you can bring that into it. You've got the one where you've got the constancy of the object, that it is not something that will be destroyed. Secondly, you have the fact that it cannot be contaminated by impurities. Thirdly, it doesn't lose its luster. So when we say, you know, and there have been writings about this, stories that have been told, even TV shows, to where you have this kind of idea that, well, if heaven is going to be this place without conflict and you know, only good and everything, won't it be boring? I would rather be down, you know, you've actually heard people say it, rather be down there where we can have some fun, you know, and you know, I'm a kind of a rowdy guy, so I'll be bored up there. No, that's not. It doesn't fade away. The glory of heaven never fades. It never loses its luster. You have a flower, it will fade. I was watching a little bit of is it Fixer Upper, is that what they call it? The one with Joe and today, and they had put some new shingles up, or they were going to put some shingles up because they built on a new section of house. And so what he did, he laid out on the ground so that she could look at it what the old shingles looked like and what the same exact color but a new shingle was, and said, we can't put these together because the old ones had faded. They'd been on the roof for such a long time that they didn't look anything like the new ones because it faded with time, and so it was necessary to re-roof the whole house. But that's we're familiar with that kind of thing. But I think that what Ian said is something, or kind of was bringing this idea of a luster, is that how it does impact us, that we don't have to concern ourselves with the fear that maybe after a period of time that the joy will wear off with regard to our being in the presence of God. It will never get old. It will never become tiresome. It will never be bored, because it does not, that glory does not fade at all. No matter what. So all three of those things teach basically the same principle. They come in slightly different directions, but gives us, I think, some color as to the nature of that inheritance. And then the final phrase, reserved in heaven. And that one I don't think needs particular explanation. That's where it is. It's not here on earth. It's in heaven. Mystic.
Just going back to the fade away, I was just kind of thinking about that. And it brought out and brought that it never loses luster, but in our finite mind, you might say the opposite is true, because there's no way to we really understand. We know how wonderful we will be in heaven. We won't know until we get there. So actually, it's going to increase when we make it into heaven. So it won't fade away, but it'll even get brighter, or whatever water juice you want to use, you know.
Yeah, there's some, but so often that happens. Our expectations outstrip the reality. And so, you know, we're looking forward to that new movie, or we're looking forward to that new book, or that new adventure. And then when we actually get there, we're disappointed because it's not exactly what it was advertised to be. Well, we don't have to worry about that with heaven. It will far outstrip anything that we can imagine.
Sam.
Yes,
there are three ways of appealing through language to a human. Their intellect, our emotions, or by proving that we as the speaker are credible. And anytime you have a list, which these three things are so closely associated, it's an emotional appeal. And that last phrase, reserved in heaven for you. And then, if you keep going, Peter's writing to these Christians, and we talked about the nature of Peter, how emotional he is. And I think that's something to really hold on to in this section, is that he's getting them excited about Christianity, and you can feel the emotion that's compounded with him. I mean, that's why it seems inconsequential to have synonyms there, but it's really augmenting the emotion.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Paul does the same exact thing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just, when I go to Romans chapter 8, as you're reading through that, it just builds and builds and builds. And same thing, the last part of 1 Corinthians 15. Any time the New Testament writers, and of course there is the Holy Spirit that guides them in this, but they give descriptions as to the nature either of our victory, the complete nature of the victory is in Romans 8, or the nature of that eternal place to where we will go, the reward itself. They're going to do the very best they can to describe it in terms that will grab us. And he certainly does so here. Anybody else? All right, next question then has to do with those who will receive the inheritance. He says in verse 5, it is those who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. And we've talked about this, and that's one of the reasons I didn't do a lot in regard to the idea of the security and what is contained in it, because we've studied this on several occasions recently and in some detail in our lessons in Ephesians on Sunday morning. But you'll notice here that it is reserved for us who are Christians. And so now then we get into the concept of suffering. And the contrast, perhaps, as Brantley alluded to, the great description of the inheritance is to elicit emotions in them. This is something that I want to be a part of. This is something that I want to receive. And you're going to get it. In all of its glory, you're going to receive it, he says. And so you have a reason, verse 6, to greatly rejoice, though, for a little while, if need be, you've been grieved by various trials. So here he indicates that, in effect, whatever it is that you're going through here on this earth and the difficulties that you have, and there are specific trials that are under consideration. These, brethren, we may not know exactly the nature of the persecution. It's difficult for us to correlate the specific events by going to secular history to which Peter refers here in this particular text. We do know that throughout the history of the first century church, there was first persecution from the Jewish leaders, and of course then there were persecutions that came from Rome later on in the century. But the fact is that anywhere Christians went as a result of proclaiming such an amazingly different, unique message, I forget, was it was in Ephesus where they said to Paul, about Paul, that this this message has been preached, has turned the world upside down, and is being preached here too. And so this thing was something that would really upset people. And so everywhere it was preached, there was going to be repercussions for the preaching of it. And we suffer the same kinds of things today. We're very fortunate that we have a culture to where religious tolerance has been so prevalent and so much at the forefront. But it's waning, and we certainly see at least a rise in antagonism toward those who call themselves Christians that are present in the world today. So we're kind of experiencing some of these kinds of things. When you declare your faith, when you stand up and actually convict individuals of sin, then there is criticism that is raised as a result of it. And it can reach that point where persecution comes, whether it be a economic privation, as individuals lose their jobs, or people won't buy their goods, or even physical persecution that might come, even death. So, you know, persecution was happening here. The extent of it, the nature of it, we don't perhaps know entirely. But he does talk, if you'll notice, going over to chapter 4 and verse 12 of the text, he said, "Don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial," which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you. In fact, this serves as a good correlation to the verses we're reading, because he says in verse 13 to rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings. When his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. So the reproach, the persecutions, the tribulations they were suffering, I think is accurately described in verse 6 of chapter 1 as for a little while being grieved by various trials. Now we do want to note the nature of those trials and tested by fire. And when I say the various trials as far as the nature, again, we may not know exactly what's being suffered, but we can give some parallels. In the King James Version, by the way, if anyone does have that particular translation they're reading from, it is referred to as manifold temptations. And so I wanted to address that for just a moment. I want to ask the question, which translation is more accurate, trial or temptation? Because basically the Greek term can be utilized in two different ways. And is there a way that what is being referred to in this particular text could be both trial and temptation? Is there a differentiation between trial and temptation?
Like, trials can lead to temptation, but they aren't necessarily temptation.
Okay, so what can a trial lead to?
Well, take for instance our society, and you talked about the waning tolerance for religion and religious ideals and everything. Well, if it becomes illegal to speak against an issue, that could be.
Can lead to.
Mixing it now. But
you're going the right way.
I mean, the preaching of that through a difficult time will be the trial. You know, if you preach that from the pulpit, somebody, calls you on it and you have to pay a fine. Okay, there's the trial. Well, if that causes you, that could tempt you to not ever teach on that again. And, the trial was the fine. The temptation would come afterwards, depending on your mindset and your resolve.
Okay, so if we were to look at it then from what we might refer to as the enemies without that beset us, and they foist upon us these tribulations and these difficulties in our lives, how does God look at what's happening to us? He's looking at it as a testing, right? And that's what comes out as the verse progresses. So, in what way could a Christian show himself to be unworthy and ungenuine in regard to his faith in the midst of those trials? I think it is what Josh said, is that it is when he does not handle it correctly. He is not constant in his faith. He compromises. He's quiet. Rejects even. So from God's point of view, the trials that men present for us, they are temptations with regard to our faith It's just a different kind of temptation than what we genuinely refer to when we think about an enticement of the devil that's trying to bring us into sin. Trials and tribulation can cause us to sin as well, so they can serve as temptations as well. So again, the reason I bring this up primarily is because I don't know that it's necessary that we say, okay, King James Version's wrong and New King James is right, or vice versa, because the way in which the term is used, it can be translated both ways, and depending on the direction you're looking at it, both of them are valid. Now, I think both of them are valid here in this context as well. Because he is talking about the need for constancy in the midst of persecution so that you prove yourself to God. So trial and temptation both is under consideration and concept.
Yep. But both are similar, like you said. But you could say all temptations are trials, but not all trials are temptation. You can be tried in other ways. All temptations are trials, but you could be tried in another way. You know, saying, if you're tempted, that's a trial. You're going through trial by that temptation. But not all trials or temptations. You can be tried in other ways. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I would have thought we'd put it opposite.
Even that, yeah.
No, just in the sense that any time you are persecuted and or have a suffering of any kind, because it may not be something people are visiting upon you. It may be because of your health, or maybe because of a lack of money or something like that. You're going through a hardship, and all of those things can be a cause for an individual to lose his faith or to turn away from God. But when we're talking about temptation, it's not always hardship, I guess. Sometimes temptation is a man is drawn away by his own lust and enticed. And so there's not necessarily hardship. So,
it's not necessarily a hardship, but it's always a trial.
So there's I think, what we might refer to as... that's just it. When I think of trial, I'm not thinking about necessarily a testing. I'm thinking of a hardship is the way that I took that in regard to. Let me give you the definition of trial. Maybe that will be helpful to us. It's the Greek word para, P-E-I-R-A-S-M-O-S. That's, of course, the anglicized version of it. I don't like to try to pronounce it because I always get them wrong. But it is an experiment, attempt, trial, approving. Specifically, the trial of man's fidelity, his integrity, his virtue, his constancy. And so it can have reference to adversity, affliction, and trouble. So there goes into a pretty good explanation of what's under consideration here. So when there is something that is happening that brings into question whether or not we will remain faithful, retain our integrity, be virtuous. And by the way, the word virtuous typically in Scripture has reference to a courage that comes with conviction. I love that term, because when we use the term virtue, what do you, a virtuous woman or something, we think about someone who's pure. Virtue in Scripture typically it has reference to strength, a courage in the midst of adversity. So a virtuous individual, add to your faith virtue. That's moral courage is what's under consideration. So those kinds of things, they can come into question. You are put into the fire whenever these difficulties in life present themselves, whatever those difficulties may be. Afflictions, troubles, adversities. Okay? Alright? Does that make everything clear as mud? Alright, so let's look at the second part of this verse then, or the second part of this phrase. So you've been grieved by various trials that... And this is where the testing comes in, and what is accomplished by the testing. So this is when God sees you going through these grievous things for this period of time, and you go through them with that constancy, with that integrity, with that virtue, then what happens? The genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So there we have this idea of being tested by fire. And again, just want to make note of it. If anybody wants to add anything to it, I think we all understand. As a precious metal, fire quenches the chaff, the impurities that are in the gold, and purifies it. And this is a validation. You know, you'll even hear people say on TV, genuine 24 karat gold plating. Yeah, but which isn't gold. But 24 karat gold. You know, if you've got something that's genuine 24 karat gold, that's all there is genuine gold. And they use the word genuine. And that's the same word that's being used here, the genuineness of your faith. It's like gold that goes through the fire. All the impurities are gone. All that's left is the metal, the precious metal itself. And that's what happens as we come through our tests and tribulations as well. All right. Comments about that section? Yes, Dick.
Of course, the it says about by fire is referring to each individual Christian, and it uses a gold, you know, the gold that perishes. Though it says about, he talked about your faith, and he says then gold that perishes, though it tested by fire. He talked about the faith being tested by fire. Part of familiar with that over in 1 Corinthians 3, 11 and following.
1 Corinthians 3, 11?
Right. Now, he's actually speaking of the personal workers that convert people. Not all of them are going to remain faithful, but the same thing is here. So it says,
good point. If y'all will, no, make sure you turn over there, 1 Corinthians 3:11, because the point that Dick is making does do a good job of illustrating what we're talking about. Go ahead, Dick.
It says, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, and straw, if each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. Of course, we know that the wood, hay, and straw will not hold. And if any work has been built on it endures, he will receive a reward. And this is where it gets into talking about the personal worker. They don't lose anything because the one they taught the gospel to went astray.
Okay, it's a good point. Good point, Dick. And I just to make sure that everyone understands what Dick is saying, because there is some misunderstanding of this particular passage. If you'll go back up to verse 9. He's talking about, well, verse 8 actually, he's talking about the work of him and Apollos. That Apollos watered, I planted, God gave the increase. Now, verse 8, he who plants and he who waters are one, and each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. So it's always why it's so important to go to context, because in the context, the Apostle Paul is talking about the people that you teach. God gives the increase. But your labor here is laboring in the Word to bring souls to Christ. And so he talks about what he has laid as a wise master builder in verse 10, laying the foundation so others build upon it. So Paul comes in, he establishes these churches, and then others come in and they preach the gospel, and other Christians are made as a result of their discipleship. Now, what happens? If you convert individuals, and those individuals that you convert are characterized rightly by the description wood, hay, and straw, then when the testing comes, when the trials and tribulations come, what happens to those individuals? Well, their faith is shown to be not genuine, as we go back to our point. Whereas if you have individuals who are described rightly by this text in verse 12 as gold and silver and precious stones, when the fire comes, then those individuals will stand, and their genuineness of their faith will be seen. And so that's why when he says in verse 14, if anyone's work which he has built on, it endures, he will receive reward. So it is a reward, it is a blessing, it is a good thing when you, as you preach the gospel to individuals, convert individuals whose faith is genuine. And when that testing comes, they stand strong, and that's a good thing. But the point he's making here in verse 14, verse 15, if anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet as through fire. So what that indicates is that I am not held accountable for the lack of genuineness on the part of anyone who I might convert. If they're tested and tried, they fall away, well, I will suffer loss. That's something. In fact, I've suffered that loss. There have been a number of individuals that I have preached to, that I have baptized, that are no longer faithful. And sometimes I feel that suffering terribly. In fact, that is a burden itself, that a trial or a tribulation that afflicts me when I contemplate and consider those individuals. But that doesn't in any way invalidate my standing with God, nor will it, if my faith is genuine, cause me to lose my soul. I will remain steadfast, and I will be saved as a result of it. But the language that is being used here in 1 Corinthians 3 is very similar to what we find there in 1 Peter chapter 1, of this idea of wood, hay, and straw be burned up. When we're talking about our faith, we don't want to be wood, hay, and straw. We want to be gold, silver, and precious stones, because those are constant, and those will be shown to be genuine when it comes through that tribulation. All right?
Well, another thing it teaches here in 1 Corinthians 3 is personal work.
Yeah, the necessity, the importance of building, the importance of going out and sharing that message.
You don't have anyone, well, of course, that doesn't mean that unless you by teaching, none will obey, but yeah. But you at least got to teach. And
our responsibility is to plant and water, going back right. to the text. That's right. Good point. Okay, now going down, if you will, to the as we go down through verse 8 of the text, I want you to notice this where he says, starting with verse 7, the genuineness of your faith may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom, having not seen, you love. Though now you do not see him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory. My question is, consider in verse 8 in light of Jesus. Consider that verse in light of Jesus' words to Thomas. So, would someone read for me John 20, verses 29? This has reference to the occasion where Thomas finally saw Jesus, the resurrected Jesus. And you'll remember he was given that invitation to put his finger in the nail holes and his fist in the side. To prove to him that it was indeed Jesus who had been raised. And what did Thomas say? Can you remember? My Lord and my God. So that was his response. Now this is what Jesus said to him in verse 29. Cassie, since you're there, would you read it, please?
Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed."
Okay. So is that parallel to what we read there in 1 Peter 1? The blessing pronounced by Jesus upon those who have believed without seeing. It's parallel, isn't it? So why? What was the lesson he was teaching Thomas on that occasion?
His faith wasn't genuine at that point. His faith would have been genuine, and he wouldn't have needed to see, touch.
Okay, I don't know if we'll go so far with not genuine, but there was something lacking in that faith. Yeah, it was weak. Okay, so yeah, that would be a good example, a good description. It's kind of an interesting thing. I listened when I went to hold a meeting in Beaver Creek, Oregon, Beaver Creek, Ohio, where Heath Rogers preaches. We had a class, and it was on Doubting Thomas, and it was on this particular text. And what Heath called Thomas was an honest skeptic, and was actually saying that we need to be like Thomas in certain ways, to where the Bereans in their nobility, they searched the scriptures daily. They didn't take what the apostles were saying at face value. They searched the scriptures daily to make sure. But when they found out that what was being claimed was so, then they accepted it. Okay. Then I've read an article that was written by Lewis Zamora, who's the preacher in Austin, where he was pretty rough on Thomas because Thomas required something that the others did not. And so the skepticism of Thomas was not something to be pleased about or to be praising. So I think it's in part kind of the way you look at it. There was a weakness to Thomas' faith, but when he was presented with the evidence, then he embraced it and he accepted it. So whenever there is some weakness to our faith and the evidence is presented, then we need to be accepting of it. We need to have that honesty. But there is something to be said for individuals. And those who are Christians who are in this class are of that ilk, just as these individuals were. to where we look at the evidence, even though we don't see the resurrected Jesus, like Peter himself saw. We don't see the resurrected Jesus, and yet we believe anyway. It's called faith. And there are many individuals in the world that ridicule our faith. They call it superstition. They say that it is unverified and unverifiable, and as such, we're fools to believe it. And it's kind of an interesting thing that the Apostle Peter here refers to a group of people who had listened to the first-hand eyewitness testimony of the apostles. But they themselves were not there. They were not among those who were eyewitnesses of the Christ. And so they had to take the word of these individuals. So it was not done in a corner. And the apostles all said, basically, the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 said, he appeared to me also as one born out of due time. And so these individuals saw the resurrected Jesus, and they were testifying of it. Now, a couple of lessons to be learned from that. One, recognize that the testimony that we receive is verified testimony. What Peter wrote down was something he himself saw. And when Peter was making these claims that I'm an eyewitness of the resurrected Christ, accompanying those claims were miracles that he performed. And so the signs to show that what he was saying was so were actually delivered. And so we have a verified eyewitness account that have God's imprimatur that Jesus indeed was the resurrected one. But it is necessary still that we accept those things, because we are not going to see the resurrected Christ until he comes again. And then it'll be too late. So we're blessed if we believe, not having seen. And it is something to be said for those who are willing to accept it. We're not overly credulous. We are simply accepting the verified testimony that others have given. Okay? All right, we will pick up then with the next question. Discuss the part the prophets of God played in the revelation of God's scheme. That's where we'll be next week. Thank y'all for coming.